Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Leadership Now with me, Dan Pontefract, today in the house of Leadership Now, Rebecca Kirstein Resch. Now, who is Rebecca? So first a bio of you, Rebecca, Bex as I call you, and then we're going to get into something quite particular and specific about both your world, kind of what you're doing and what you just put out into the market. So who is Rebecca? Serial entrepreneur, an ally to the next generation, and a relentless architect of possibility. That's one of the best opening lines I ever had. She's the founder and CEO of Inkly, an inclusive knowledge sharing platform that is revolutionizing the future of work by providing all people with equitable access to the knowledge and opportunities they need to foster fulfillment, connection, and yes, folks, purpose at work. Rebecca has worked alongside world-renowned educators, researchers, and technologists as she's followed the thread of human growth and development from the classroom to the workplace and back again in search of transformational systemic change. One of her career highlights was sharing the stage with her hero and the most watched TED speaker ever in history, Sir Ken Robinson. And fun fact, I too was in the audience for that one. Rebecca envisions a world where everyone has access to opportunities for meaningful work and fulfilling lives. Rebecca, thanks for joining me on my little show called Leadership Now. Now, partly for reasons that I'll get into as we discuss during our conversation today, I've invited you today because you've actually recently published a white paper entitled Questions Are the Answer. That is so cool. The subtitle is Improving Business Impact and Employee Well-being by Democratizing Access to Knowledge, co-written with a fellow Canadian, Dana Folwar-Vogt. So I'm curious, emphasis on the word curious, what is at the root of this white paper? Let's start there, and we're going to dig into a few other morsels as we go through our discussion today.
Love it. Thanks for having me, Dan. And I actually forgot that was where we first met in person, was at that event. I think we'd communicated online before, so I'd actually forgotten that. So thanks for bringing that up. But yeah, the root of this white paper is really the work I've been engaged in for the last 7 years that's really culminated in something I cannot look away from now that I know what I know. And it is abundantly clear, overwhelmingly clear to me that this sort of technology paradox that we're currently caught in is not only hurting people at work, it's hurting people all over the world. And so the way in which we use technology, the way in which technology is designed, is directly linked to our loneliness epidemic. It is directly linked to our connection crisis, as many call it, at work. And I think we can actually do something about it. And I know I can do something about it. So that's at the root of the paper. There's a lot more to it, but that's the core.
So there are, I would argue, several itches you're scratching with this particular paper. It's phenomenal. It's just short of 10,000 words, and you dig into some serious societal, workplace, human being issues. Not the least of which, I think one of them up front, you're discussing sort of the human energy urgency. And what I like about this point, as provocative as it is, it's kind of you suggesting that there's an impact actually on both productivity from a personal and professional sense, so organizational and individual, but also well-being, of which one would argue the organization should be paying attention to the well-being of its people. So can you help us elaborate a little bit on what human energy urgency actually refers to, and how, maybe even as an added bonus question, what are the sort of traditional workplace practices that are failing to address this urgency?
Yeah, it's the reason I wrote a paper is because it's a big topic. there's a lot to say, and there's a lot contributing to it. And it's, as anything involving humans, it's complex. And so there's a lot of layers there. And the human urgency, the energy urgency, really refers to human sustainability. So going beyond organizational sustainability and actually looking at the problems that are related to human sustainability, which, what, as you always like to say, what powers our organizations? People. And so when people's energy is depleted, they are not productive and they're not well. And those two things go hand in hand. If you have people who are not well, you have people who are not productive. And so all this promise of technology improving productivity, if you look at different sources of information on this topic, productivity is actually dropping. And it's dropping because the more and more we throw technology at the problem without thinking about how we use that technology and how that technology is designed. And I'll use social media as the greatest example ever of extractive technology, technology that's designed to keep our attention on the technology and not on the people around us or the work around us or the humans in front of us, that we're really facing a massive human energy crisis that technology is contributing to. It's not the only source by any means, but technology at work in particular is an area in which we have so much more control. Not only, you know, are we using technology like social media ad nauseum in our day-to-day lives, it's absolutely intertwined with everything we do. And of course, at work, leaders have an opportunity to say, we're going to do this differently. This technology that we're using at work, in many cases, legacy technology, but we continue to add more technology without subtracting. And I get to that in the paper as well, without looking at how each piece of technology is integrated or not with the other pieces of technology and what the impact of that technology is on human energy, because that is a core sustainability factor when it comes to organizational sustainability.
Well, in the paper later on, you get into sort of what you pointed out, which is a sort of a technology paradox, where the paradox of technology both connects and isolates us. And whether we're feeling that with social media, always connected, always on, yet never together, or inside the organization where the Slacks and Teams and other discussion forums, it all started back in SharePoint, I would argue, but that's a whole other story.
That's
like
SharePoint.
but you write in the paper, like it or not, intentional or not, technology is transformational. We just don't often see it coming, and it isn't often what we expect. And you say in the paper, we're going to present our case for a more human-centric, outcomes-based approach to productivity and the importance of designing and implementing human-centric tech augmented solutions. And so you're almost calling out right in the face of leaders and organizational higher-ups. It's kind of like, well, look, duh, we have technology and we need it to improve our performance, to be more effective, to think about productivity in a way that is, like EBITDA savvy, I'll just call it. But at the same time, we can't lose sight of this paradox, this brewing and rising loneliness in people's lives. And so from a strategy perspective or from a leverage perspective or just from an aha WTH perspective, tell us a bit about this paradox and kind of this notion that you're uncovering and what you're suggesting to others.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The promise of productivity that comes along with technology, you know, if you look at it in isolation with, you know, just how we use Slack or Teams, which you brought up, or just how we use social technologies at work, you know, the Yammers all the way up to the Facebook Metas and everywhere in between, or Facebook Workplace or Meta Workplace, whatever it's called these days. it changes every 5 minutes, I feel like. But all of those tools can be great in and of their own use case. And if you look at the data from just the one tool, you could say, oh, we're so much more connected, or we're sharing knowledge, or we're answering each other's questions, or whatever those outcomes are. When you look at the technology in isolation, you can say, point to, oh, we're increasing productivity because of this or this in each of these areas of technology. But when you look at the big picture, and there's new companies, there's a company actually out of Vancouver called Produce 8 And they're actually looking at the technology use across the organization. You know, how much technology are we using? How often? And if you look at the data, it's overwhelming how much time people are spending. The average knowledge worker is spending over 11 hours a day, almost 12 hours a day, using technology. And when we're supposed to be working, and that's workplace technology, when we're supposed to be working 8 hours a day, that's insane. Right?
Wow. And 11 or 12 hours a day in a 24 hour day.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And that's right. No wonder we have a human energy crisis. And that isn't even taking into account all of the other ways in which we're using technology. Like that is a low number compared to what is probably true that we can't prove. And so if we're all using technology that much, the one place where we actually have control as leaders over the technology we're using and how we use it, why wouldn't we start there? Why wouldn't we start at work and say, what are we using? How are we using it? How is it actually helping us? And how much time are people spending there? And so the reality is that this promise of productivity is actually decreasing productivity because we're spending so much time context switching and between technologies, even when they're integrated into our workflow. If you ping me on Slack or Teams and interrupt me in what I'm doing, and I feel because my organizational culture tells me to feel that I should respond to that really quickly, then I break my deep work to attend to that. And it can take up to 30, 40 minutes to get back on track with whatever it was that I was originally doing. And that, we do that all day, all the time. And we don't have a lot of literacy around digital wellness at work. And we certainly don't have policies and practices that support that. And so no wonder we are where we are.
Well, you mentioned, you know, the hat tip to Cal Newport's deep work thesis, and in and amongst us, I couldn't help but think with Tristan Harris's world and how he developed Infinite Scroll and ironically said that's the worst thing I ever did, and now trying to fix sort of and undo a lot of what he's suggesting as to this infinite staring at screens, I'll say, and this dopamine hit that seems to have been enveloped society like an addiction that I had to toffee as a 13-year-old. So you also make the case in the paper, though, that actually, and you've touched on this, there's an anxiety and stress and burnout relationship to our always on, always adaptable, always there. And so whether, you know, you brought up data points like the World Health Organization, the UN, estimating that this burnout is costing us about $7.8 trillion globally. So that's a lot of zeros. And that, you know, whether it's Gallup or Deloitte, Statista's, everyone's data is pretty much the same, which is, look, anxiety, stress, burnout, et cetera, have been on the rise since, you know, the early aughts. So we're 20 years into this technology thing, but it's actually harming performance and productivity. So you've got both the human issue and you've got an organizational issue. So reconcile for me why we continue looking at technology as a savior.
Yeah, love that question, because technology alone is not and will never be the savior. But it's certainly, as you mentioned earlier, it's incredibly intertwined in our lives. It does improve our lives in many ways, but that's the paradox, right? It's, you know, I would argue that cheese and wine improve my life in so many different ways, but overused, those things are not great, right? And so when we look at this, and look at how we can solve this problem, what we're not realizing, I think, at scale, especially in organizations, is that there's so much that goes into the way technology is designed. As a you know, product manager and technology designer myself, we are building more technology, but we're building different technology. We're building technology that is designed with the human's needs at the center. And why that's so important, and you mentioned Tristan Harris and the Center for Humane Technology, is this old extractive paradigm of technology is what got us here. Mm-hmm. And so the same way social media has created all of these challenges, those same ways in which we're developing technology translate into the work environment. Social technologies at work are run the same way. And it's inextricably linked to our economic structures, right? As a founder of a technology company, I have had to work a billion times harder to find investors and VCs that believe in the kind of technology I'm trying to build. Because if it's not growth at all costs, and instead it's value, human value at all costs, that's going to impact our bottom line as a company. It's going to take us longer to build what we're building. And so the incentive is what needs to change. And that's a big systemic problem that if VCs are driving founders of startups like ours to build companies with growth at all costs, well, then we're going into your workplace and we're making sure your people are on our platform as much as humanly possible. And that over and over and over again with, you know, dozens and dozens, some organizations, hundreds of technologies, of course, not all designed in the same way, but hundreds of technologies and every user using dozens of technologies a day, there's no way that's not affecting our performance and our well-being.
I want to point out as well, tangentially, that the paper is full of hope and, dare I say, even answers. One of those is about curiosity, and you posit that, you know, fostering this culture of curiosity is actually essential for well-being, for innovation, for performance. So, without technology, just as a behavior or an attribute, tell me a bit about a culture of curiosity in that environment and how ultimately it might reduce barriers for people to ask questions.
Absolutely. I'm a big proponent of curiosity. there's so much to say about curiosity, but at the core, I think curiosity is about psychological safety. And when we have safety to be curious, to ask questions, when it's open in our organization to not have all the answers and to not have a culture built around leaders have all the answers, and instead leaders have all the great questions. Those are the kinds of shifts that we need to make in our organizations. Because right now, when you look at the data on psychological safety in organizations, people are afraid to ask questions. People are afraid to say, I don't have the answer. And simply by creating space to ask questions and to communicate and share knowledge with each other, we're saying it's safe here. It's safe here to ask questions, to not have the answers, to solicit the knowledge and expertise of the people around you. And that's critical to sound decision-making in business, is to not be the person with all the answers, but instead to check in with colleagues and diverse colleagues across the organization. I don't know what somebody on the other side of the country could know about the very topic that I'm struggling with. And we don't have tools that allow us to connect with people in diverse parts of the organization. And it's a critical gap that, you know, some of these workplace technologies are still creating the same silos that we have with email. The same way you have a Slack channel, you can have an email thread. but this idea that we could start to expand that beyond who you know, not only contributes to a culture of curiosity, but it also contributes to psychological safety, and it contributes to inclusion and diversity. It doesn't matter who I know, or that you and I maybe went to Stanford together, and so that's how I can tap on your shoulder and know what you know. Everybody at every level of the organization can have access to the knowledge that exists, the breadth of knowledge that exists across their organization. And we just don't have the tools for that today.
Yet there's an irony, isn't there? Because, you know, research like European Medical Journal 2022, who found that in a sort of a test of employees who were sort of fed, if you will, the curiosity quotient versus those who were almost by leaders told not to be curious and kind of stay in their lane or stay in their silo, those that were encouraged to be open, curious, collaborative, et cetera, far more engaged, far more productive, far more well when you took a look at the data from their overall life and job satisfaction and performance. Yeah, the irony I'm asking you about, Rebecca, is this not a leadership issue? Like, why is it that leaders don't see your point of when there is psychological safety, when a culture of curiosity is actually at the core of how we're going to conduct ourselves in between units, whether it's cross-country, cross units, et cetera? What is, I guess, getting in the way of this?
I think it absolutely is a leadership issue. You know, I think we have been indoctrinated into cultures that leaders have all the answers, right? And that certainly, even in my own small way with a small team in a startup, I embrace that the reason I've hired the team around me is because I don't have all the answers. And I think that's where it starts, right? It really does start with leadership teams that are not only hiring great people because they know what they don't know, or they have expertise that they don't have, but additionally creating not just the spaces where knowledge can be shared, but the tools, the access, the culture, the processes. I mean, it's embedded in everything, and technology can only augment the culture that we have. And so if we have a culture of knowledge hoarding and not sharing and not being curious, and it's not safe to ask, and I don't even know who to ask, well, any technology we're using is just going to be a diagnostic of that, show us that that exists at scale.
I guess, like, added to that is leader humility. I mean, if the leader thinks that they need to know all the answers and aren't humble enough to put themselves in a situation whereby they acknowledge they don't have an answer, then they're obviously not humble and don't demonstrate humility. That's going to have a trickle-down effect to the team, who either won't demonstrate said humility either, or, as you mentioned, they're afraid to open up and say, I don't know, for fear of reprimand or some other devious outcome that results in the fact that they're too scared or fearful to actually open up their mouth and say, I don't know. Where, anyone got any ideas?
Yeah, exactly. And how many times there are opportunities for that build such trust amongst teams, especially when the leader is the one who steps up and says, hey, everybody, this is a doozy.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And I don't have the answers here. There's so many great examples that I'm sure, going way back to Frederick Laloux's work in reinventing organizations. And there's so many great examples and stories of leaders doing exactly that in big ways in organizations. I can't even remember the details of the stories, but I've seen this in person, and I'm certain that you've seen both sides of this play out in leadership positions in your work. And it's powerful. It's powerful when a leader steps up and says, I don't have the answers here, and here's where I'm looking to you, my team at every level, to get involved and to come together to solve big problems. And I know I've done that in a startup. And it's not only built tremendous trust, it's gotten us through difficult times. I mean, I founded a startup in February of 2020, the most prime time ever to launch a startup. And we've all gone through hell and back together. And if we didn't come together to solve some of the big challenges we faced, not only would we not be a strong team, I don't think we would have gotten through the times that we did.
Fair enough. You also point out another issue, but you have a pretty cool and salient observation of how to mitigate said issue. And the issue is the connection crisis. So as a result, potentially, of remote work, hybrid work, certainly post-COVID, post-pandemic, but just, I think we were easing up to this crisis point with your connection crisis point, I should say, prior to the pandemic, which is the always on, but lonely. And as you point out rightly in the white paper, you know, Dr. Vivek Murthy, the U.S. Surgeon General's report in 2023 May issue, I believe, about how loneliness is kind of the new smoking and thus a new epidemic at both work and in life. So where I'm going with this is, Tell us a bit about what connection crisis means to you in the work and the research that you've put together, but then the effective ways to build what I think is your antidote, which is a clever way to say HQCs, high quality connections. Take us down a path of both of those concepts.
I like that. I really do believe that this loneliness epidemic is fueled at work. When we all left the office and went home, that was, I think for many people in many different ways, really disconnecting from the workplace. And for those of us who, you know, were really enjoying the culture of our work, that abruptly stopped. And, you know, we had all of these responsibilities at home and we're trying to manage that and juggle that. And it really was disconnecting in that you're working and especially for parents, you're working and constantly trying to balance the family obligations at home and feeling like you're disconnecting from your kids and trying to keep them in another room while you're doing your work. And then when you're with your kids, you're trying to disconnect from your work. And I mean, this just like snowballed. And we all know what that was like because we all experienced it in some way or another, and some of us more deeply than others. And I think that is really what is still persisting, in that we're now trying to find our way towards a future of work, if you will, that is already here, in which we're trying to understand what that looks like for different team members and how we can be both connected and disconnected at home and at work with technology, with our families, with our work itself, and manage all of that is a real challenge. And the way in which we're disconnected from the humans in our lives, because we are spending so much more time on technology, these HQCs, as we call them, the high quality connections, are more critical than ever. And there's a great study from BetterUp that I reference in the paper as well, that really surfaces some shocking data around how disconnected people feel and the lack of trust in coworkers. Mm. And, you know, people who have been hired during the pandemic, who have spent little or no time in person with people, have had sort of fabricated experiences of connection through, you know, Zoom cocktail hours and things that people were doing during the pandemic that really weren't working, especially when you look at the data on how those things went over with different employees. And those team members, you know, really haven't had a chance to develop high quality connections with anyone. And it's absolutely critical that we develop those connections. And it's possible through technology. I have had them myself throughout the pandemic, where I've developed really high quality connections with people that I would call very good friends over the last few years. And so if we can do that one-to-one as organizational leaders, we can facilitate those kinds of high quality connections, and they're critical to our attachment to our organization, to our job satisfaction, to our ability to do our jobs when we have people to reach out to when we're struggling. I mean, the layers of why that's so important are just growing as we become more and more geographically disconnected, and disconnected by sheer technology and the fact that we aren't in offices together and we won't be, even those who are forcing back to work. I don't think that's going to fly for very long. So that's a whole other story.
So in addition to HQCs, your high quality connections, you make reference to, which I can't believe is more than 50 years now, Thomas Granovetter's work and the strength of weak ties. Yet you emphasize the importance of virtual weak ties as part of your almost repertoire of being less lonely, more connected, et cetera. And this helps, in fact, the curiosity, the innovation, the knowledge sharing. So what are these practical steps that you'd like organizations to consider, if not, you know, infuse, to strengthen these virtual weak ties, at least to start the conversation about their importance and maybe what to do about them?
Yeah. So your question is, how let me make sure I got this right. How are we to approach enabling virtual weak ties? Is that the essence Bingo. Of the question?
Yeah.
I think it's, I get into this in more detail in the paper, but enabling weak ties, as we've just talked about high quality connections, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily mean that we're, old friends who get together every week. These high quality connections can happen virtually. We could not necessarily ever be in the same room together. But those weak ties, those, and Mark Granovetter's work, I too was like, when I went back and I realized that it was 50 years ago, I was quite shocked by that as well. But these weak tie connections are where our knowledge and our new opportunities actually come from. When you look at the data, it isn't people who are pals like you and I might be, where we actually don't live very far apart. We could get together in person for a coffee. We're much less likely to provide each other with opportunities than someone who's a weak tie in an organization and someone who's a good friend or family member. And so those weak ties are, again, limited in the sense that in an organization, whoever's around us in the old model where we sat at a desk was kind of the limit to our weak ties. Now those weak ties can extend to people all across our organization. We could have thousands of people in different areas of the world. But we need to start creating organic ways for people to connect and build those weak tie networks. And there's no better way to do that than through technology when we're not bumping into each other. And there's no better way to create equitable access to those opportunities mm-hmm. because it isn't about who you know or who you happen to rub shoulders with in the department you're in or around the water cooler, as we love to say. Those kinds of connections can now happen and we can facilitate them as an organization using technology, but still use the technology to facilitate person-to-person connections, not person-to-AI connections. Those are great too to find information, but the person-to-person dynamic using AI and thinking of it through that lens of how we're using AI to connect people to people is what really interests me, that I believe can solve a lot of the challenges around HQCs, weak ties, knowledge sharing, and connection at work.
So related to that then, in my penultimate question, is sort of you make an advocate for the case for human-centric approach design or human-centric approach to the technology itself. Mm-hmm. And as my good friend, the tech humanist, Kate O'Neill, would agree with you, what are the elements then that make up sort of human-centric technology such that organizations can look through that lens and see how a culture of curiosity can create HQCs as well as virtual weak ties?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Center for Humane Technology, again, I'll call them out because they've done an incredible job of creating a lot of resources. So highly recommend, reference that in the paper as well, in terms of not just people building technology, but students and leaders in organizations understanding, what does this even mean? What does it mean to look at technology through a human-centric lens? And is this technology extractive? Is it distracting people from the real world to bring them onto the technology platform as much as possible? Or is it actually facilitating their thriving? And that's, at the core of everything we do is to say, as much as it would be great to have people on our technology platform 24 hours a day, is that great for the people? And ultimately, that's not going to serve our technology either, because we're heading down this rabbit hole that has no end and it doesn't look good. The end is near and it's not going to be good for technology companies either. So if we're not looking at this lens where we shift to a more human-centric, less extractive, less attention-focused, but instead focusing on creating value for humans with the technology. And so I'll use the example of our technology. We are designing so that people can use the platform to find the people and the weak ties and the connections they need to find knowledge that they wouldn't otherwise have. and ultimately get back to what they were doing and not be incessantly pinged all day, to create the safety to ask questions. So I think this is so much better illustrated through examples, which is why I did that ad nauseum in the paper, gave some examples of the how, because I think it's one thing to talk about it in concept, but to really talk about it and what does that mean in terms of features, removing excessive notifications, you know, getting people off the technology, getting them in to get what they need and getting them out again. I mean, there's so many different ways that we can change the way we design technology, but we have to change what the incentive is. And for a technology company, if my incentive is to keep you on the platform as much as humanly possible, that is automatically misaligned with your human thriving. And so we really have to look at this as the systemic problem that it is.
So you've segued quite nicely to the final question, which is ultimately, well, if you're the CEO and founder of Inkly, tell listeners and viewers what it is that Inkly does so that it's not just another technology, and how does it support the arguments that you put forward in the white paper itself?
Well, thanks for asking. I've used it as a few examples, but Inkly is ultimately social knowledge sharing technology. And why we call it that, it really is a new category of technology. And the social part is really a double entendre in that in many ways, it is social in the sense that we are connecting people to people, but we also have a social outcome in mind. We want people to use the platform every day because that means they're getting knowledge, they're getting resources, they're making connections using the technology that's actually helping them do their work, move forward, solve problems, solve challenges in their life and in their work. And that when we're successful at that, of course, people will use the technology every day. But the intention is not to ping you incessantly to bring you back again, is to create those intrinsic motivators that allow you to safely ask questions at work, using AI to match people to the right content, to other people in the organization, to diverse perspectives, so that we are ultimately building on knowledge, so that we are solving big problems and that companies are able to innovate because their people are able to build on the knowledge that already exists because they're freely sharing it between people in the organization, which has this lovely byproduct of actually connecting people through the work itself. And that's our goal.
Well, isn't that just perfectly landed? You landed the balloon. It was just great. Where can we find out more about Rebecca and or Inkly then?
I love it. You can head to inkly.com and you can find me, Rebecca Christine Resch, on LinkedIn. And you can find the paper on our website as well. It'll be up in just a couple of days. So.
And for listeners, that is inkly.com, yes?
That is correct.
Excellent. Well, Rebecca, thank you first and foremost, not just for this discussion and for making available such a powerful piece of research. You've curated all kinds of data points, and the argument stands on its own, I believe, that we don't need more tech. We do need tech, and we have to rethink kind of ways in which to make tech more humane in a way that allows us to be better connected, less lonely, certainly driven by, I hope, a higher sense of purpose, that we're kind of on this planet for one reason. That's to kind of love and live with one another equally, don't you think? Yeah.
I really do think. You and I see eye to eye on that one.
Well, it's been such a joy. Thank you for this. And folks, again, please head over to Inkly, inkly.com. You'll grab the white paper there. It is a gem, just short, as I mentioned, of 10,000 words. It's called Questions Are the Answers, Improving Business Impact and Employee Well-Being by Democratizing Access to Knowledge. Today in the house, Rebecca Christine Resch, CEO and founder of Inkly. Thanks for listening, everyone. Catch us another time on an episode of Leadership Now with me, Daniel Pontefract. Thanks, Bex.